is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The problem is that all the internet stuff is just a kind of prelude to something else. Prelude to greater crackdown, harsher use of force, you know, more detentions of peaceful protesters.
That was David Kaye, a law professor and former United Nations rapporteur on how many governments are shutting down the internet in times of crisis. Details coming up also. 39 migrants are dead trying to cross the Mediterranean. And 3 days of mourning has been declared in Equatorial Guinea. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The nightly internet shutdowns in Myanmar are part of a strategy employed by many governments worldwide in times of crisis. But they come with costs. VOA's Michelle Quinn reports.
Nighttime in Myanmar, the country enters a digital curfew. In the morning, people check their phones to see if the internet is on. Then thousands jump on Siphon, a circumvention app to access sites such as Facebook, Twitter, and others, which the military junta has ordered blocked. From his office in Toronto, Canada, Michael Hull, president of Siphon, can see as people rush to get on Siphon's servers. Siphon works with media outlets such as VOA.
The number of occurrences is unprecedented. And then from our point of view, from Siphon's point of view, the number of people that are having to utilize the Siphon network even after the network is restored is a new phenomenon.
It's unclear why the Myanmar military government, which seized control on February 1, is conducting nightly internet shutdowns. Governments typically argue that an internet shutdown helps maintain security in a time of crisis. Since the takeover, Myanmar has erupted in protests, with dozens of protesters killed. David Kaye is a law professor at the University of California, Irvine, and a former United Nations special rapporteur.
The problem is that all the internet stuff is just a kind of prelude to something else. Prelude to greater crackdown, harsher use of force, you know, more detentions of peaceful protesters.
In 2020, there were 155 internet shutdowns in 29 countries, according to Access Now, a nonprofit digital rights group. While fewer than in the prior 2 years, the blockages are still damaging. India, with 109 shutdowns, mostly in Indian-administered Kashmir, had the highest number. In Belarus, the internet went down in the European nation for 61 hours in August, after the presidential election. In addition to shutdowns, some governments are installing new censorship and surveillance capabilities on the network. Cambodia is setting up an internet gateway that critics say will give the government the ability to surveil and censor internet users. A U.S. State Department spokeswoman expressed concern.
You know, we have a significant amount of Khmer Americans who are here in the United States, and we want to ensure that they're able to freely speak to their family and their friends and relatives who are still back in the country.
In a place like Myanmar, internet shutdowns and blockages of social media sites come with economic costs and political risk. David Kaye.
But they're also just deeply unpopular. It's, they must really want to shut down the information flow because people rely on the internet.
Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
The Tunisian Defense Ministry says at least 39 migrants died when two boats sank as they tried to cross the Mediterranean to the Italian island of Lampedusa. Ministry spokesman Mohamed Zekri says the Coast Guard rescued 165 others and searches for more survivors are still going off the coast of Safax. All the dead migrants were from sub-Saharan Africa. The coastline near the Tunisian port city of Safax has become a major departure point for people fleeing conflict and poverty in Africa and the Middle East and seeking a better life in Europe. For more on the Tigray conflict in Ethiopia, VOA's Jason Patinkin reached to Alamayehu Waldemariam. Waldemariam is a professor of constitutional law at Mekelle University in Ethiopia's Tigray region, but he is currently in Boston due to the conflict.
Now, the conflict broke out on November 4th when TPLF forces attacked government military bases in Tigray following a constitutional dispute. It's been 4 months of fighting. We are now seeing international outcry. Why do you think the international community is beginning to speak out so forcefully now?
It's puzzling to me that it took long for the international community to react. One reason why the international community is reacting in the way it does now is by dint of the fact that so many investigative reports are coming out. These reporters, in their nature, are very accusatorial or damning of what is happening in Ethiopia. Mass atrocity crimes are taking place. Mass killings in Aksum, in Edagahamus, at the Mariam Church, which was covered by CNN. And those damning reporters, human rights reporters by Human Rights Watch, and very recently by the Amnesty International. So the international community, made the right call.
And let's look at some of those reports. You mentioned Human Rights Watch. They reported on indiscriminate shelling of urban areas in Tigray, allegedly by Ethiopian government forces. Amnesty International reported that Eritrean troops allegedly killed hundreds of people in the town of Aksum. You also mentioned CNN, which reported on what it says was a massacre by Eritrean troops at a monastery. The Telegraph, which is a British newspaper, reported on a video showing some 40 civilians who were allegedly killed by Ethiopian government troops. Vice News reported on satellite imagery showing destruction of Tigray villages, which suggested what it called ethnic cleansing, allegedly by Eritrean forces. You know, when the fighting began, Abiy's government said it was a limited law enforcement operation targeting some leaders of the TPLF. In light of all these reports of atrocities, how do you assess that claim of a limited law enforcement operation?
Well, Abiy wanted us to believe that it was a limited law enforcement operation. To be more precise, it would have been like a federal intervention into the region based on some constitutional provisions that authorize federal intervention on some grounds. To be honest, you cannot have a surgical operation like the one that Abiy wants us to believe in Tigray, because you are fighting against a region that has been beefing up its security for the past 2 years and a half. The war was inevitable, was pretty much obvious to observers of the region. I have been writing about this since the beginning, that this is going to come. All conditions were satisfied for an armed conflict. So a surgical operation of the kind that Abiy wanted us to believe was impossible, because both parties to the conflict mobilized thousands of forces for a conventional warfare. But after November 28, that warfare changed into, it morphed into a robust insurgency.
Now, it's important to note, Eritrea has denied its troops committed atrocities and doesn't acknowledge its troops are even in Tigray. Meanwhile, Ethiopia's government says that it's investigating any credible allegations of atrocities and serious human rights abuses. And Ethiopia's Human Rights Commission has investigated other abuses, notably a massacre of hundreds of civilians at Maikadra, which the commission and Amnesty International blames on a Tigray militia, although media reports have been more mixed as to who is responsible. Do you think Ethiopia's government is credible in terms of investigating allegations against it and its allies, or do you think there needs to be an independent probe, which is what the UN is calling for?
The Ethiopian government cannot be trusted with a task like this, because it's a party to the war itself. So the only credible institution that can do this is a UN-mandated fact-finding mission.
And last of all, what might be next for Ethiopia? There's supposed to be an election coming up this year, although some opposition parties say they won't participate. There has also been mass violence in other parts of the country. What might be next, and what could be done to ensure peace?
I think the first thing to do is to end the hostilities. There needs to be a ceasefire to ease the humanitarian suffering in all parts of the country, including Tigray. And there needs to be a dialogue, a political dialogue. I cannot see an election doing anything good to this country anytime in the future before this conflict is resolved. I think there needs to be a comprehensive national political dialogue to be had among all the political parties. Probably there also might be a need to form a transitional government, because the government that calls itself a government doesn't seem to enjoy the legitimacy that a government needs to have, because a civil war necessarily reflects badly on any government.
That's Alamayehu Weldemariam. He is a professor of constitutional law at Mekelle University in Ethiopia's Tigray region. He is currently in Boston due to the conflict. Professor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jason.
That was Alamayehu Weldemariam, a professor of constitutional law at Mekelle University in Ethiopia's Tigray region, speaking with VOA's Jason Patinkin. Equatorial Guinea has declared 3 days of mourning for 105 people killed by explosion Sunday at an army barracks in the coastal city of Bata. An Associated Press report also indicates 615 people were injured. Investigations into the cause of the blasts have begun. President Teodoro Obiang Nguema visited the damaged barracks and said his government has declared the city of Bata an area of catastrophe so as to activate urgent measures to help those affected by the blast. The impact of the explosions has damaged almost all the houses and buildings in Bata. The city has roughly 170,000 inhabitants. It's becoming increasingly difficult for Libyan-nominated Prime Minister Dabiba to get the confidence of the House of Representatives following objections to 7 nominated ministers in his proposed cabinet who will be replaced. Despite optimism from the UN envoy and U.S. ambassador, this cabinet faces troubles from its inception, threatening the attempt to unify the war-torn country. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Chenawi discussed these developments with Wolfgang Porstei, former Austrian military attaché to Libya.
Actually, there are 3 problems with the cabinet proposed by the Dabiba. The first one is the size of the cabinet. The next one is the allocation of the ministries to the various provinces. And there are also some problems about the names. Expectations were for a slim cabinet of experts, about 12 to 15, 16 ministers. The Dabiba proposed 35 ministers and state secretaries. His intention is probably to broaden the support for his government by having so many ministries covering a wide range of stakeholders and also a wide range of members of parliament. We see if this works in the long run. Cyrenaica claimed that they did not get any important ministries other than the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Ministry of Health. It could be also debated because the Cyrenaica also got the heads of the National Oil Corporation and the Central Bank of Libya, which are 2 key positions for the country's economy. The Cyrenaicans are also not satisfied with several of the persons selected for their slots. 7 names will be replaced right now. An example, Lamia Fati Abu Sidra was nominated for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. She does not have experience in diplomacy whatsoever, but she also does not live in the Cyrenaica since years. Some of the other ministers, not only from the Cyrenaica, were involved in corruption, forged university degrees, or are considered close to Islamic extremists. So many troubles on the list.
What are the troubles facing this cabinet from its inception against optimism expressed by the UN envoy and the U.S. ambassador to Libya?
While it is certainly a positive move if Libya has in the future only one government which is legitimated by the parliament, it is doubtful that the right people are in it. Nevertheless, Unsmil, the U.S. ambassador Norland, and others consider this as an opportunity to overcome the failed Shkirat agreement and to get rid of the deadlocked Serraj government, and by this to get things moving. The main purpose of the Government of National Unity is to organize the elections in December, as agreed in Geneva. The troubles on the way to these elections are many, including that time is running out for organizing nationwide elections. There is no electoral law, it is not even clear where the electoral districts are. If there should be even a referendum on the draft constitution, as it was also discussed, before the elections, There is absolutely no way that the national elections can happen this year. Another key challenge is the very, very low voter turnout in all the elections since after 2012 at local and national elections.
Why does the international community push so hard for a vote now before the UN panel of experts report on alleged bribes that marred the elections?
They fear that delegations in the UN panel of experts report about bribery and vote buying around the nomination of the presidential council, and especially around Prime Minister Abdulhamid Abeba, could erode the support for the GNU in the House of Representatives and finally prevent the House of Representatives from endorsing it. This would lead to another domestically not legitimated government in Libya, replacing just a government of national accord with a government of national unity. And this would make things in the run-up to the elections much more complicated. They do not want to risk a failure, as all of them, the United Nations, the United States, the European Union, and several European countries like Germany and Italy, have put the whole weight behind the Libya Political Dialogue Forum process. There is no plan B for them. And I guess they consider a legitimated government, starting with a corruption case, the lesser evil to continuing with the non-legitimate and also corrupt Sarraj government.
So what can be expected after the government is approved by the HOR as expected?
Let's start with the technical side. The new confirmed ministers need to take over their ministries, which are split between the East and the West, hundreds of kilometers between them. This could lead to ministries located for quite some time on two locations. It could also very well be the case that Prime Minister Dabeba himself and the House of Representatives will reside for the time being in Sirte. This could make sense because this city is obviously accessible from both sides of the split country. On the political side, it is important that Dabeba builds trust among all those who have supported him for the time being. This ranges from the Muslim Brotherhood to Marshal Haftar's Libyan National Army and from Turkey and Qatar to Egypt and the Emirates. That's a real challenge. He needs some quick wins. Such a quick win could be an agreement about the distribution of the still frozen oil revenues between the three historic provinces, while the overall budget will be still managed by the Dabeba's central minister of finance. Another important task would be to consolidate the ceasefire, including and getting also the international civilian monitoring mission into the country to prevent the resumption of hostilities in the oil crescent, which could otherwise end the project of a government of national unity too early.
That was Wolfgang Porstei, former Austrian military attaché to Libya, speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. With no end of cash shortages in sight in Zimbabwe, the use of mobile money has become the order of the day in the South African nation. As Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, the central bank says it is happy with the situation and wants 90% of all transactions to be electronic.
For years now, Zimbabwe has faced an acute shortage of cash that has forced people to switch to mobile money. An informal sector is booming in the electronic exchange of foreign currency for the local currency, or in some cases, the other way. This is called RTGS, or real-time gross settlement. Informal trader Sylvester Mupfumiri explains.
Generally, the bond loss, most people are not accepting them, really, because they are losing value. So generally, people don't want them. So people prefer to use the RTGS for easy movement of doing their business. Yeah. So that's why they're preferring the local currency in RTGS form. Also, it has a better margin when they get it from the streets, because we are offering 1.1, while it's the auction rate of the government is being offered at 83 point something.
The process is profitable for traders, and some have left their formal jobs, such as teaching, for it. But it's a hassle which is technically criminal. That's why some traders do not want to be identified, such as this man. Zimbabwe's currency is worthless, he says. That's why people, even those formerly employed, come to us in the streets looking for foreign currency. That's how we survive, he says. In a statement to VOA, John Panone Samangunjga, Governor of the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe said he was happy with the current trend in which around 80% of the country's transactions are conducted electronically. He said, "Our goal is to see Zimbabwe becoming a cash-light society where at least 90% of the monetary transactions are conducted through electronic products that include plastic money, mobile banking, internet banking, and electronic transfers." But Moses Chundru, an economics lecturer at the University of Zimbabwe, disagrees with him.
In this era, you want to go 100% cashless, but you need to be very careful when you look at statistics. What we are celebrating at 80 and hoping to get to 90 may not actually be a success story. So people still need cash. To the extent the electronic money itself is not yet fully acceptable to the transacting public, people are still not trusting their financial system, especially the central bank, because they've bent their fingers once in 2008, twice again another statutory instrument stole their savings. If you notice people, when they get paid, they swipe out everything they've earned the next day or so. You want to move it as quickly as it can get out of there. Why? Because we are not yet trusting the store of value function of our currency.
Zimbabweans generally prefer keeping US dollars or South African rand to preserve its value in case Zimbabwean currency loses even more value or electronic cash becomes unworkable or is declared illegal. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwe's economy is subdued, and while inflation has slowed down, it remains on its upward trend. Yet, the Zimbabwe Stock Exchange is one of the best performing stock exchanges on the continent. Reporter Kudzai Zadawashi has the details.
Podcast host Kudzai Mbaiwa has been urging ordinary citizens to be part of the Zimbabwe Stock Exchange, or ZSE, based on its performance.
So the year-to-date returns on the Zimbabwe Stock Exchange as at the last week, is this past week, we're just a little bit over 45% year-to-date, and this is returns in real terms, so in US dollar terms. In other words, someone who put in $100 would be sitting right now on a value, assuming that they'd invested in the entire, you know, exchange, of about 45%.
She says, in light of the inflationary conditions, many are looking to preserve the value of their income.
With our inflation beginning to once again rise, there is a lot of Zimbabwe dollar that is around, and it has to find a safe haven.
In many other economies, people invest their money in banks and expect a single-digit annual interest, but such low margins can be eroded by inflation, and the Zimbabwe Stock Exchange has proven to be more rewarding.
Outside of the region, the more there's information, the opportunity of the internet, more people are aware of the opportunity of the Zimbabwe Stock Exchange. We actually regard it in quotes as a frontier market, and those that want to take chances will do so. Across the world, you hardly find places where you get a double-digit return. We are beating the JSE, and last year we were just ahead of, you know, everyone else as well, and I think that historical performance, though it is not a guarantee for the future, is always something that gives comfort to incoming investors.
Mubaiwa says, while foreign investors are looking to exit the Zimbabwe market, there is also more awareness by locals and ordinary folk, and those people can buy shares for as little as $5. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Ihiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat and dumbolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the internet.